Hello, I am Bob Vessels and I am from the Netherlands. In my podcast, Rembrandt's Money, I will be telling you unexpected stories about Rembrandt, the famous Dutch painter. Compelling and fascinating stories. Hardly about art, no, about his almost unknown life as an entrepreneur, about Rembrandt's business, his finances and his legal affairs. In 2024, I am planning 24 podcast episodes, so around every 14 days. Every episode is between some 15 to 25 minutes, and all for free. If you want to know more, please visit my website www.rembrandtsmoney.com. Welcome, or welcome back again. What I'm going to tell you now, we didn't know until the 1960s. Rembrandt had a relationship with his housekeeper and the caretaker of his son, Titus, or Titus. Her name was Geertje Dirks, and she was about 4 years younger than Rembrandt. It was shortly after Saskia's death. Geertje became Titus' caretaker in 1642. At that time, the boy was some 9 months old. Rembrandt began a relationship with her. Later, this relationship became a thorny path full of legal disputes. That lasted until the mid-1650s. Geertje is even listed as one of Rembrandt's creditors in his insolvency proceedings. So, today, in this episode, Geertje Dirks is in the spotlight. Who is Geertje Dirks? She grew up in a simple family in Edam. That's about 20 kilometers northwest of Amsterdam. Her older brother, Pieter, was a carpenter and a sailor. This Pieter also lived in Ransdorp. Ransdorp officially became part of Amsterdam in 1921. In the 17th century, women like Geertje often became maids. When they agreed, they could leave their hometown to become nannies. Of course, with a respectable family. Also, to increase their chances of a good marriage. Geertje was probably illiterate. She signed documents with a cross. It was a swastika, which at that time did not evoke any bad associations. As a 24 years old, Geertje married the trumpet player Abraham Klaas from Hoorn. Hoorn is located about 20 kilometers north of Edam, or some 40 kilometers north of Amsterdam. A trumpet player? Yes, probably on a ship to warn other ships, very safe at night or in the fog. He blew his last march in 1635 and died. Investigators believe that Geertje worked as a nanny for Treintje Bates in Hoorn after his death. Later, as a widow, she stayed with her brother in Ransdorp until 1642. She probably lived and worked as a droge min for Titus and as a housekeeper for Rembrandt. I translate it as a dry min. A dry min is a nanny who doesn't do breastfeeding. Saskia died in June 1642. Titus was 9 months old at the time. Rembrandt began a relationship with Geertje that lasted until about 1648. It all ended very unpleasantly. Raymond and Geertje lived openly together as an unmarried husband and wife. In the social circles in Holland at the time, this was viewed with disgust, especially in church circles. 70 years later, Rembrandt's biographer Houbraken tells us more about Geertje. Houbraken describes Geertje as a country woman, in Dutch boerinnetje, from Ransdorp, rather small in stature, but well-shaped with a plump figure, in Dutch, wat klein van persoon, maar welgemaakt van wezen en poezel van lichaam. During their intimate relationship, Rembrandt gave his lover Geertje the jewelry that had belonged to his wife Saskia. We can assume that things went well between Rembrandt and Geertje for quite some time. After 6 years, she visited notary Laurens Lamberti to draw up her will. Her will is clear. Should Geertje die without legitimate descendants, her mother will be her sole and universal heir, who will receive a net and legal share of her estate. This includes all of Geertje's linen, woolen and other fabric clothing, but nothing else. Geertje does wear jewelry, but this is not named as clothing. Geertje left all her possessions to Titus in the will. He will be her sole and universal heir. Titus may decide about these possessions forever, according to his wishes, as where it was his own property. Literature acknowledges Rembrandt's influence over the text of the will. Titus was a boy of about 7 years old when the will was made. One author refers to Rembrandt's involvement with Geertje Dirks and writes, "Geertje Dirks, who probably, while Saskia was still alive, was Titus' dry nurse and with whom Rembrandt had a sexual relationship." End of quote. It was not until the 1960s that authors like Vis and Wijnman described Geertje's life in more detail. Until then, this personal relationship remained hidden in art history, sometimes just mentioned in a one-line footnote in veiled terms. As to the jewelry mentioned, according to Van der Veen, these are the pieces of jewelry that Rembrandt had previously given to Geertje. Originally, they belonged to Saskia. Do we know how Geertje looks like? Van der Veen assumes that Rembrandt made portraits of Geertje. You can see them in my blog on my website, rembrandtsmoney.com. At the end of the 1640s, Rembrandt and Geertje had a serious difference of opinion about Rembrandt's alleged promise to marry Geertje. A promise to marry Geertje? What happened here? According to the laws of the time, a promise of marriage, the promise made by one person to another to enter into a marriage with them, was in principle binding. Such a promise could be confirmed by a symbol, like a medal, a notarial deed, and in some cases in the 16th and 17th centuries with intercourse, in Dutch bijslaap. Only with a good reason or without the consent of the parents could a marriage promise be broken through the courts. What was 400 years ago the idea behind this marriage system? Well, it shouldn't be too easy to deviate from the promise to marriage. After all, that promise was given before the eyes of God. Sometimes the repayment of a token was necessary to avoid a lawsuit. What was the law in these days? The so-called Hollandse Consultatien is a rich and influential collection of legal advice and case law in Holland at the time. We learn that reasons for breaking a wedding promise include unchastity, double promises, a promise made under the influence of alcohol. In literature, you will also find serious illness, debt, hatred, a change of religion, and differences in social class. Around 15 June 1649, Geertje left Rembrandt's house and moved to a room around the corner, without alimony. On 25 September 1649, Geertje accused Rembrandt of breaking the marriage vow. She did so by using a proceeding decided by the commissioners of the Chamber of Marital Affairs. Rembrandt didn't appear in the chambers and he was fined the usual sum of 1 guilder. Matters between Geertje and Rembrandt are heating up. After much wrangling, the notary draws up an agreement to settle their differences. Rembrandt agrees to pay Geertje a lump sum of 160 guilders immediately after signing and, for the rest of her life, 60 guilders every year. And, if she so desired, he would assist her annually, as he saw fit, according to her real and reasonable needs. Geertje, however, refused to sign the contract. Both continued to argue over all the details in their agreement. Then the notary intervenes. He writes, "Nevertheless, I, the notary, explained to her," that's Geertje, "in words that the agreement contained nothing but these conditions. 1. That Rembrandt would pay her a lump sum of 200 guilders immediately so that she could redeem her possessions. 2. That beyond this she would receive 160 guilders annually for sustenance of her lifetime, but no longer." By the way, 160 guilders is roughly half what a workman in these days would earn. And 3. That moreover, her last will in favor of Titus, which she had drawn up before me, the notary, would remain inviolate, and that henceforth all actions and claims which one might have had towards the other would be null and void. In the words of the notary, Geertje Dierks then admitted that these conditions were indeed agreed upon, but that she did not want to sign the agreement under the pretext that in the event of illness or other infirmity, a maid or a nurse would require more than 160 guilders annually. And although Rembrandt said that he was willing to adjust this at his discretion, Geertje Dierks did not want to sign an agreement before that time. A few days later, on 16 October 1649, Geertje Dierks again summoned Rembrandt to appear before the commissioners of the Chamber of Marital Affairs. The hefty disagreement continued until the commissioners, like good men, passed their verdict. Rembrandt would not pay Geertje 160, but 200 guilders, and that every year of her life. A week later, Geertje realized that the hope of a legal marriage had gone. Whatever the reason, if it was ever a romance, those days were over. Over half a year later, Geertje Dierks is imprisoned in the Spinhuis in Gouda. The Spinhuis is a spinning house. This type of detention was usually carried out at the request of the family. A spinhuis had as a function to punish convicted women and bring them back on the right path. The woman had to work hard in large halls by spinning fiber yarn, twisting loose fibers into thread, and sewing. The spinning house housed women who had been punished for pickpocketing, theft, fraud, prostitution, and keeping illegal boarding houses. We do not know the reason for Geertje's detention. There is no documentation on this issue. According to Cornelia Jans, who is the woman who brought or accompanied Geertje to Gouda's spinning house, Rembrandt appears to be a party in this affair. Cornelia recovered the costs of Geertje's transport and the assistance she gave from Rembrandt. It's an amount of 140 guilders. No less than 4 years and 8 months in prison. In 1652, Geertje Dirks asked the board of the Amsterdam Reformed Church to inform her family members in Edam of her situation. She hoped that they would apply for her release. The church rejected it because this was a secular matter. The council had no power to decide on such a matter. On 3 May 1656, a woman testified on Rembrandt's behalf that 6 years before, in 1650, at the request of relatives of Geertje, she had helped to bring her to the House of Correction in Gouda. There she paid out approximately 140 guilders, a sum which was reimbursed by Rembrandt. A few days later, on 6 May 1656, at the request of Geertje, two women made a statement. Geertje was living in Edam at the time. According to the statement, Rembrandt asked two of Geertje's family members to agree to an extension of 11 years in prison in Gouda. But the family members didn't agree to that. 11 months earlier, another witness, Trein Jacobs, went to see Rembrandt. She told him her plan to have Geertje freed from the spinhuis in Gouda. Rembrandt warned her not to do that, wagging his finger and saying, "If you go there, you will be sorry." In the documents you read, in Dutch, "Bij aldien gij heen gaat, het zal u rouwen." Nowadays, this would be regarded as a very serious threat. Trein nevertheless continued her journey. In Gouda, she learned that the magistrate had received several letters from Rembrandt. In these letters, Rembrandt forbade Geertje's release until her brother would return home from abroad. The statement ended with, "After that, the witness, with great trouble, at last obtained permission from the same gentleman that she be released from the spinhuis, as then happened." End of the statement. Based on recent research in regional archives, it is now known that Geertje was released on 31 May 1655. Historians, including art historians, are not averse to melodrama. They don't shy away from juice and gossip and taking sides. They also seem to take pleasure in acting as psychologists or behavioral experts. That's also the case with Geertje. Rijksmuseum curator Bicker depicts Geertje as a manipulative person. She brought out the worst in Rembrandt. In 1899, already an author, Lucht, points out that anyone who investigates the Geertje incidents will be surprised that a woman formerly so good and faithful to Titus suddenly becomes so greedy, short-tempered and unjust. In 2019, Simone van der Vlucht takes offense at this rather negative image. She emphasizes Rembrandt's unreliable and vengeful traits. Dutch literature of the last 30 years has described Rembrandt's behavior as vindictive, authoritarian. We cannot, however, fully substantiate these assessments with the available legal documentation, as historian Bosman argues. Very recently, Gilte writes that it is not easy to understand exactly what happened. However, he joins Bosman's side. Whatever, it is a nasty fight with embittered ex-partners. Geertje is portrayed as a manipulative seductress. She was said to be after Rembrandt's money. Or is she the victim of a man who is determined to get rid of her? Also recently, Moser points to all these other proofs of Rembrandt's repulsive character. Without that evidence, we might give Rembrandt the benefit of the doubt, he says. I am more comfortable with Moser's conclusion. Is this any business for us? That's it for this time. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. Would you like to know more about this story? There's an extended version of it on my website, rembrandtsmoney.com, as an addendum to this podcast entitled Geertje Dirks. It also includes some illustrations as a background to my story. In an upcoming podcast, I'll try to unravel two legal issues. First, about a general belief that Rembrandt transferred his house to his son Titus in 1656, and two, that Rembrandt thereby harmed the interests of his creditors. I promise I'll wake you up, answering those questions differently. How? I'll explain that to you next time. I hope to speak to you again and convince you.